welcome back to Lasher and Survivor Girls. It's another episode of Creepy Real Horrorcast. I'm Mistress Meg.
I'm Lunchbox.
And the Haddonfield train just keeps on rolling.
Oh, God. It's rolling with square wheels is what it's doing. It's just clunking right on down the road.
Yeah, it's awkward, bumpy, and a little uncomfortable on the butt.
Yeah, it's terrible.
So in case you haven't figured it out, this week we're doing Halloween 5, The Revenge of Michael Myers. Not sure what the revenge part is, but okay, we'll get into that. First, though, just a reminder, subscribe. We'll follow on your favorite podcatcher every Tuesday. Join us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Slasher, at Creepin' It Real, R-E-E-L as a movie reel. And if you like us a whole bunch, you can get our merch and rep us on the streets at creepinitreal.redbubble.com, where there's a link in the Instagram bio. And apparently, the masochism keeps happening because Lunchbox wants more ideas for shitty movies.
Yep.
So email us at creepinitreal.cm@gmail.com with your suggestions. Also questions, because why?
Listen, if I have to go back into our analytics and actually see, like, what are some of our more high-performing episodes, it tends to be some of the really shitty ones. It's or ones that are
Freddy's Dead is overperforming.
Yeah, so. I'm like, this is blowing my mind. Like, just as a new episode, like, Jaws the Revenge is doing pretty good too. So I was like, you know what? It's like, let's just keep that going. It's like,
maybe to pepper things in.
Yeah. It's a weird palate cleanser is what that is. Is because we could do a bunch of really good movies, and then it's like, you know what, let's have especially like since we're doing franchises, it's like we'll just throw in a bad movie every now and then and just have some fun with it.
But so many franchises are full of bad movies.
And this one is right there with it. I'm not gonna sugarcoat it. But yeah, that's the thing, is the idea is to get some, you know, even if it's just like a bad B-movie or something like that. I mean, something that might be fun. I mean, there's movies that are literally just bad, and then there's stuff that's like just awesomely bad. Like, I'm talking like a trauma movie or something like that, where it's like,
yeah, it's entertaining.
Yeah, it's like, I would love, ooh, I just had a brain idea. Things happening, sparking. The Alani is working right now because I just had an idea off recording.
Yeah. Okay, off the record. We'll talk about this later.
We'll talk about this later. But yeah, so that was the thing, is for this, it's like we wanted to get through the franchise, and Megan decided to pick the franchise that I least like.
Hey, I've already explained this. It's because we're going to actually be able to do a timely episode for the first time ever in the history of our show when Halloween Ends comes out in October. We have...
But this is because I made you watch Jaws the Revenge. I made you sit through that. This is the reason why.
I mean, it doesn't not have anything to do with that. But mostly, the biggest reason why is because we had the perfect number of episodes to get us all the way up through to Halloween Ends in October. So... that's the biggest reason why. I mean, yes, slowly punishing you for making you watch Jaws the Revenge.
I mean, I would have rather poison.
That's...
I mean, you could just slowly drip
no,
that in.
No, this is punishment. Is that little bit of seasoning on the steak. Like, the whole idea was really good, but we are getting into the rough patch of the Halloween series right now. The shit in the 90s. Woo! Oh boy. Okay, so Halloween 5 was released on October 13th, 1989. It was made for a budget of roughly $5 million. It ended up only grossing $11.6 million worldwide. I guess this is the lowest grossing film of the series. Can't imagine why. It was written by Michael Jacobs, Dominique Othenin-Girard, and Shem Bitterman. It was directed by Dominique Othenin-Girard. The film itself starred Donald Pleasence as Dr. Loomis, Daniel Harris as Jamie, Ellie Cornell as Rachel, Bo Starr as Sheriff Meeker, Jeffrey Lamman as Billy, Tamara Glynn as Samantha, Jonathan Chapin as Mikey and Wendy Foxworth as Tina.
I'm actually very, like, pleased that you pronounce the director's name right. It's like, because that is, like, one of the harder names to actually, like, get, like, on the nose. So it's like, well done.
French?
No, but that's, no, but it's just funny because, like, I've heard other people say it, and it's,
let me amend it. His name is Dominique. Like Aaron.
Mm-hmm.
Or D-Nice.
D-Nice.
For the Key and Peele fans out there.
I would be C-Rig.
Can you talk about Aaron?
But yeah, so thinking up just weird, like, different names would be better than watching this movie. Like, so that was the thing is...
So I will admit, once upon a time, this was actually... Halloween 4 and 5 were two of my favorites somehow.
Strangely enough, mine as well. Like, when I had to, like, go into a what I liked about Halloween or whatever... 4 and 5 always tended to be the ones that I would gravitate towards. For some fucking reason, I don't know why, but it's just like, the more I watch it, it's just bad.
So what happened here? This time with a critical eye, you went in and you really just, you pulled the thread on the sweater and it all unraveled?
No, the sweater was already gone. It was a fucking tube top at this point. And then I just went in and I just burned the shit. I just threw it in the incinerator because it was just that goddamn bad. Like, when I was a kid, a little wee lunchbox, that's when I got into this mode of, like, oh, I like this, I like Michael Myers movies because it's like, oh, he's a killer, he does all this, he's, you know, can creep around a house where he's really quiet, and then, with Daniel Harris, I was like, and 4, I remember really liking her, but then being very confused in 5, but still liking her, like, it was fine. But again, I was maybe like maybe 7, 8 years old or something like that. Because like these were like movies that my dad would actually allow me to watch because they really weren't that terrible.
Well, they weren't gory. No. There's not really any swearing in them.
I mean, to a degree, but even then it's like, I remember it's my dad would always, you know, allow me to watch certain thing, you know, movies, as long as there wasn't a ton of F-bombs and
sure
things like that. So they tried to keep it contained, but they also know that those words are going to be out there. And I think we do that with our kids. I mean, they've heard all types of stuff, so
mostly out of my mouth.
Yeah, you're terrible with it. But
I'm human, sue me.
You're a sailor, that's it. But that was the thing, was like, it was a type of thing where some of the stuff that our kids watch, I mean, it's funny when I a couple of the times I've gone to play Pokemon, there's a couple of moms that'll go there, and I mentioned that, oh yeah, like Owen, like he absolutely loves Scream, and they're just like dumbfounded that, you know, we let our kid watch that, and it was just the...
Which always cracks me up, because you have friends, too. For a long time, he didn't actually know how Finding Nemo began. They would skip the barracuda scene at the beginning of Finding Nemo. Little things like that. So I always find it funny when people get super fucking judgy about those sorts of things. And I'm just like, my kid's more well-adjusted than your kid. So how about we don't
judge? And like, I've tried to get them ingrained with horror, and I mean, again, our kids listen to Ice Nine Kills, and they know who all of the slashers are. I mean, our daughter is about 5 years old, and you could literally just put her in front of something and go, okay, who's this, and she'll nail it.
And she's never really easy. She hasn't really seen any of the movies. Yeah. She just watched Scream for the first time a couple of weeks ago. I had a movie night with my kids and my boyfriend's son, and my friend's kid. The two oldest boys are 11, and so we watched Scream the first time. There was definitely a few moments where she was like, okay, this is getting kind of scary, and she came and kind of snuggled up with me, whatever. But son was about the same age when he saw Scream for the first time, and yeah, he was six, almost seven. He was like six, six and a half. She's almost seven, or she's almost six. So they're right about the same age. I saw Scream for the first time, and she had a few moments where she was like, okay, this is getting a little scary, similar to what our son did. And then at the end of it, she kind of had a good time. Like, yeah. She thought it was pretty fun.
And I showed both the kids Killer Clowns from Outer Space for the first time, and you know, our daughter was just like, oh, well, like, I don't know about this. This is going to be scary. And I'm like, no, no, you're going to have fun with this.
She loved Shorty.
Oh, my God. They are uber fans for the movie. And it's like our son, he's walking around the house now singing the Dickies Killer Clowns theme song now. And it makes me oh so happy. I am the happiest lunchbox I have ever been.
It squirms your cold, dead heart.
Yeah, and it's like a microwave in here. It's just...
Careful, it'll explode.
Just heating up the Hot Pocket. Just like...
No, Hot Pocket's... Because it's still frozen in the middle.
Yeah.
Until it goes molten lava hot.
So
there's only two options on the filling on a Hot Pocket. It's still frozen, or it's burning the skin off your face.
Third degree burns all over.
Those are your two choices.
And tomato sauce.
So I watched this... I watched Halloween 5 just last night with my boyfriend and his son. And I don't remember if his son, for all intents and purposes going forward, I'm just going to call him my stepson just to make life easy. But I don't remember. I think he said he'd seen one of the Halloween movies once before. But... He hadn't seen this one. And as he's watching it, he had so many fucking questions. You should be able to pick up any one of these films, put it in, and with the basic recap at the beginning of the movie, have a pretty fair idea of what's going on without needing to see all of the other ones first. By nature of what they are. Generally speaking, the horror franchises don't piggyback off of each other very well, unless you're talking about, like, Saw. Because that's the way that was built, at least in the beginning.
Yeah, to a degree.
Before it went kind of wild and off the rails. But franchises like Halloween and Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th, a lot of those were just flying by the seat of their pants and making up movies on the fly. So continuity has never really been that big a deal. So what you really should be able to do is pick up any one of these and be able to watch it and follow along. And my poor stepson was so like, what is happening? Why is the little girl able to see what Michael's doing? I don't understand. This is it was a whole thing.
Not a real good one to jump right in as a first time watch without going into
full. Yeah, and that shouldn't be the case.
No. And thinking back to other franchises where, like, okay, so for the Friday the 13th franchise, it's very rare that they will literally pick up some type of
thread.
Thread. Usually it's like if you had, you know, some of the kids in there, or maybe they're a little bit older, it's years later, stuff like that. But it's never a literal, like, we are picking it up from the moments of the last film.
It's not like Child's Play.
No.
Where the Chucky movies did that pretty well, mostly because you had Don Mancini. That's it. Outside of what Tom Holland did, because he directed the first Child's Play movie, outside of his wheelings and dealings and kind of messing around with the script, you've only really had the one voice throughout the whole thing, regardless of who the director of whatever the thing was.
Which is really good as far as making things feel consistent.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, even though that the Chucky series had, like, I mean, as years went on, you could definitely feel like... You could almost timestamp them, but there was some type of consistency.
But yeah, that's the thing, is things would pick up and build off of things that had happened in the past. Another, and I haven't seen the series, but another one that did that fairly well, at least initially for the first few, was Phantasm. Because you had Don Coscarelli through the first four, I think,
God, I cannot. I do not. I know that's a good fan one, but it's like I remember not liking that as a kid. Like
it,
I
was. Well, I was, we might get there eventually. But that's another one that had the fortunate circumstance of having a soul voice and a soul mind through at least a portion of it until it got taken away from him, I think, after the fourth movie. I'm not super familiar with Phantasm. Mm. It's one that's been on my radar, but it's not one that I've really jumped into.
I always remember liking the tall man and the metal ball. Like I was like, that's fucking cool. But the rest of the movie is like, it's confusing as shit as to what.
So you really have to pay attention.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just it's like there's these like we'll probably get into it like way down the line, but it's like there's like these weird little Jawa things that are actually supposed to be dead people that the tall man is bringing back to life, that he's making them, they're like minion things. And when I say Jawas, they're like in these like brown like druid like clothes.
Really, they look like Jawas.
Yeah, they look like Jawas. It's weird. And like because I remember watching with my buddy Brock, and I was just like, what the fuck is? I was like, why aren't they like it's just weird. It's fucking bizarre. The tall man's cool, the ball thing, but it's like everything else around is just like, what the hell? So I'm curious as to how the rest of the series goes, because that's something that I never wanted to dive into because I didn't like the first one that much.
Yeah, so eventually we'll get to that one, but that one's another example. I just used that one because it was another example of having a singular creative force. Now, Halloween did not have that. You had John Carpenter for the first two films in some capacity. He wrote and directed the first one. He was a producer and I think a co-writer on the second one. And then the third one, he was just a producer on, but because that was sort of his brainchild, you could tell there was some input in there. It felt like a John Carpenter movie. And then the rest of them have not. So part four, for its flaws, was still relatively engaging. If you haven't listened to last week's episode, go back and give that a listen. It was relatively engaging. This one, however, was not. So what happened was Gerard took one look at part four and went, great! I love what you did here. I'm doing none of that. And pushed it to the side. And so everything that was started in part four with potentially passing the torch to Jamie and it's supposed to be part one of the Cult of Thorn trilogy, where parts four, five, and six are very loosely connected. The idea was that the curse was going to be passed down to Jamie Lloyd, because there was a next of kin kind of thing. And that was completely abandoned in this one. We get Jamie has been separated from her family, or from her foster family. She's in a children's asylum being treated for her trauma. She's lost her voice. She's got this weird trauma-induced mutism thing where she just doesn't speak. She can't really communicate. She's locked up. Her brain's locked up. Our final girl from part four, Rachel, has been reduced to this flaky eye candy and is killed off within... I don't know, first 15, 20 minutes during the first act of the movie. She's killed off. And we get Tina instead, which we will get into that here shortly. So, within the first act of part five, you suddenly realize, oh, so we're not picking up any of the story threads that were started in part four. Okay, cool. So what are we doing? And you're flying by the seat of your pants the entire time as they make it up while they go along. It's a movie.
I am being very quiet right now because the rage that is building inside me is just like, as you're talking, it's just like, it's gonna pop. It's like, you're throwing the Mentos into the Diet Coke. It's about that, everything you said just boiled me. And
that's not even the worst part. No. That's the basic synopsis of Act 1, which is the most... I don't want to say the most milquetoast part of this movie, because it really, the entire movie is pretty bland, but it's so innocuous compared to the shenanigans that happen in the following two acts.
It just, it rolls downhill into just a big steaming pile of garbage. Like, it's just, it doesn't fit. And even at the end of 4, I didn't feel like that ending worked at all, because it just, they didn't explain, like, that, it's not that I'm looking for them to, you know, over explain something to me, but the whole thing of, like, just after this entire time where, you know, Jamie has been running away from Michael, there's been no real connection as to that she has with him, as she did in this movie.
The worst part of that whole thing is it doesn't get explained until part 6.
Yeah. And that's,
you have to wait, like, 2 movies to get any explanation on that. It's so stupid.
Granted, as cool as it is to actually see her in the clown costume with the scissors and the blood on her, like, I was like, that's a cool image. And then to have, you know, Loomis, like, just doing his, no, no, and then the whole, like, trying to shoot her thing. I was like, after he went through this entire movie of trying to save her, I was like, that was a little cool ending. Did it make sense? Not even close.
No, but I liked the potential of where that would have gone.
Yeah.
Because I think what could have happened was, if you wanted to follow that plot thread down the road, you would have got an explanation as to why Jamie lost her marbles. Instead, we get no explanation of that. That gets discarded, and this weird psychic link happens between Jamie and her uncle that nobody seems to want to talk about, but everybody knows about, because Loomis is trying to exploit that to get at Michael Myers. And we've got another subplot where Loomis is Captain Ahab and Michael Myers is the white whale, and Loomis has completely lost his marbles trying to get to Myers. And well,
after 4 movies of doing that same thing over and over, trying to get at him, I'm pretty, like, this, I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't lose his marbles by the 5th one.
But he was drawn worse as a character than Myers in this movie. Myers is our antagonist, he's our killer, he's the one we want to see taken down, but Loomis is the creep. Loomis is the psycho. He's abusing Jamie. He's using her to get to Myers. He's nasty to her. He's not very kind to anybody in this movie. And yes, there is an element where you can argue that the frustration has built up to the point where, okay, now he's just a wild animal trying to get to his prey. But Loomis was supposed to be likable. He was supposed to be sympathetic. And he was a man on a mission, but he lost sight of that mission and just became a nutter. What's worse is Myers lost sight of his mission. His whole goal was to get to his niece. And through, let's see, this movie is 95 minutes long. Through about 80 minutes of this whole thing, he forgets that Jamie is his mission and is going after literally everybody else. He was stalking Tina. He was stalking Sammy. He went after Michael, Tina's boyfriend, for no reason. Just because he was there. I mean, yeah, he was kind of a douche, so it was fine watching him die. But the whole point was to get to Jamie. That was set up in part 4. And we don't do that until the last 15 minutes of the movie.
The stuff that were in number 4, where Michael just, like, he knows how to get to, he's hitting all these points, and he's getting from point A to point B pretty easily. Like, mm-hmm. And number 4, the fucking cop drives him up to the house. Like, Michael's just chilling in the back seat, and then they get to the house, and then he just kind of walks his happy ass in while they're blocking everything off. But it's like, in this one, there's no urgency at all to go after Jamie.
No.
None. And even at, like, when they're at the farm and he's chasing everybody down, right, and, you know, just slaughtering all the kids having the Halloween party or whatever, and Jamie just happens to show up, that's when he's like, oh, cool, I'm going to go after you too. But it's not like that. Oh, you came here? Oh, like...
But why on earth, if his focus was on his niece, and he knows that his niece is alive, because they have this psychic link for inexplicable reasons, they have this link to each other, so he knows... Kind of like Harry Potter and Voldemort.
Mm-hmm.
Where Potter knows what's going on with Voldemort, but it takes Voldy a minute to realize that Potter knows what he knows, and then he can infiltrate Potter's mind. It's a similar version of that, except Michael has no desire to get into Jamie's head. He should be using it to find her, because that's the whole purpose of this.
Well, and they never really... there's only one moment where it actually shows that there is a link between Michael and Jamie. Usually it's between Jamie and Michael, like, so she can see what he's doing, or she gets a feeling of whatever he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
But like, there's a couple times where it's like she'll like twitch, and then they flip the camera, and then he's twitching. So it's like,
yeah, and one of the early scenes towards the beginning of the movie where he's hiding out with the hermit and
Hobo Jenkins.
He has a name too, and I can't remember what it is. But yeah. We'll call him Hobo Jenkins for now. For lack of the actual name.
Hobo Jenkins and Parakeet
Pete.
No,
he was just the mountain man.
He was just mountain man,
and
yeah.
And the parrot's name was Tipper.
Tipper, yeah.
Abort, Tippy.
Tippy, okay.
It was another Hitchcock nod, which got started in the first movie. But Jamie having the nightmare is what brought Michael back to consciousness. Was he in a coma for a year?
Having so many ragey moments.
Was he in a coma for a year?
So, after he got blasted, just with the Danny DeVito.
So anyways, it started blasting.
But like, that was the thing. Is like, so after they blew holes in him and threw him down this, which I thought was a grave. It's not a grave. It was a mine shaft.
Yeah, and he came out the other side.
So he went through the mine shaft, like, just... crawled in like Lieutenant Dan and just went through the hole, and then they decided, like, oh, we got to make sure we got him. So some deputy fucking throws a whole thing of dynamite down there, blows a fucking hole out the back, but Michael, he's already out, and he's in the fucking river, and he's going down this lazy river, and he just happens to go up to the mountain man's little
shack
thing that he has out there, and he's just, and the mountain man like takes care of him. Like, first of all, it's like, okay, he just got blasted with a lot of bullets.
Oh yeah, he's Swiss cheese.
This mountain man, they never show like, oh, like, does he have any medical? They never show him actually working on him. He could have just pulled him out of the river and just fucking left him there. But we never see that. And it's just like, but then when they do the little title card or the little card at the end where it's just like Halloween Eve, 1 year later, the fuck you say? And then he just sits right up. Like, it's just, there's so much there that I need.
So, okay. So we'll get back to Jamie in a second, because I know this is, we're taking the scenic route.
Oh,
there.
We're getting fuck all on this one. Sorry. I'm trying to be quiet. I'm trying to be courteous, but I'm about to.
But so for anyone listening, just buckle up and come along this ride with us. We'll get there eventually. So he's in a. We're led to believe that he's been in a coma for a year. If that's the case, wait. Yeah. So we're led to believe he's in a coma for a year. At some point, the mountain man had to have removed the bullets, right? Otherwise, he would have gotten a raging infection and died.
Oh, no. Michael Myers will never die. Because he's been shot before with probably no medical attention to those bullets. So all those bullets that Loomis put into him, all those bullets that the other police... This dude is just riddled with bullets, and they're just there. They are there to stay.
He will never pass through a metal detector.
No.
Fair point. Okay, so yeah. Anywho, so, but some form, any good Samaritan, some form of medical attention would have had to have been paid. Now, I understand the mountain man is the hermity type, but if somebody is injured and shows up on your doorstep, I'm fairly certain even a hermit would try to call 911 to get medical help for the aforementioned injured human.
Maybe he was like the old hermit from Frankenstein. He just wanted a buddy. He finally got a buddy. He got a nice friend that he could look after and take care of.
But Myers
and
tried
smoke
to,
cigarettes with.
But Myers tried to strangle him.
Oh yeah, no, he murdered the shit out of him.
No, but even when he showed up initially, he tried to strangle him, and then his injuries laid him out.
Yeah,
the shock wore off, and he just fell. Or the adrenaline wore off, and he just fainted. And then apparently was out for a year. Now, hear me out. I know that he's supposed to be... The shape's supposed to be some unstoppable force, right? But he still has a musculature and a skeleton and body parts. If muscles don't move for a year, they don't move at all. The atrophy is real.
So
he should barely be able to move.
He went 10 years without moving. He was laid out in bed, healing from his finger wiggles, burns, and eye damage.
You're still so salty.
Fuck this movie. Fuck Michael Myers. Fuck all. Like, I hate the continuity of them shooting his eyes out and then burning him alive and then them just coming back and, oh, we're going to get into the rest of the shit because it's like, they show his eyes.
Yeah, they put a specific focus on his eyes
close
in this movie.
Twice.
Crying.
What? Why? Anyways. So the whole thing of them, he's laid out for 10 years.
He's awake for one night and then goes down for another year.
Yeah. I was like, the fact that he's able to move the way he does is unbelievable. Because, like, for not moving after 10 years, I would have loved to see him try to stand up for the first time. Be like, oh, like,
jelly legs.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, yeah. I've sat on the toilet for too long just being on YouTube and whatnot, and then all of a sudden tried to stand up, and it's a bad time. It makes you feel like, oh my God, my leg is just jello now. It's just, that's just the way it is.
Or 2 days after leg day. That's my favorite.
Yeah.
When you're falling out, you.
I like that I went with a toilet thing and you came back with a workout thing to better yourself. You know,
I do that. I do spend some time in the gym. So you should try it. Highly recommend.
Yeah, I'm okay.
Yeah. But anyway, no, after a particularly like brutal leg day where you've decided I can add a little bit more weight, you throw a few more pounds on the bar and it's never the next day. It's the day after that. And you fall out of bed.
Yeah. I remember
it's
those.
Just like that.
I did have those days back when I played hockey. So I remember that because I played, like, skated every single day. I worked out all the time. So, yeah, my legs were fucking done. They were like, no, we're not moving. This is not happening.
Yeah, after four or five solid days of skating, I'm sure your legs were like, and we're done.
No, you're going to lay down, and you're going to play Donkey Kong. That's about it. Like, that's all you're doing.
Walking? Stupid. You'll barely make it to the toilet. So, 10 years being laid out, he's awake for one whole day. Well, yeah, we'll call it 2 days, because there was some travel time in there.
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll say he was awake for 2 days, goes back down, he's down for the count for another year. First of all, he should have been wasted away to a skeleton.
There should have been muscle deterioration.
Nothing. So, but he's up. And not only is he up, he's still superhuman strong and kills the mountain man. How's that for gratitude?
Yeah. Now, granted, it's this, like, when you really think about, like, what Michael is and...
Is the evil incarnate, the blackest
eyes. Yeah, that whole thing. Thanks, Loomis. But that was the thing is, when you, from the people that I've talked to about this and why they think Michael Myers is scary, why he is a threat, all that stuff. And they sit there and go, it's like he's a superhuman and he cannot be killed and all this other. And then I go, but why? Like, there's never like an established thought as to, like, explain how he got to that point, because through John Carpenter's 78 film, he's just a man. Mm-hmm. Like he's a big bastard, and he could take a shot, which is crazy. But it's like they make him just immune to everything.
Yeah, and it's, I hate to say it because I do enjoy the Halloween series overall, but that makes the character so much less interesting. It's like Superman. After a while, you're like, well, he's immune to everything. He doesn't really have a weakness except for glowing green cabbage. Sorry, kryptonite.
And iron.
And, like a fairy? Cool.
No, like, he can't see through iron.
Lead.
Or is it, well,
it's not iron, it's lead.
Yeah.
Because x-rays can't penetrate lead.
Yeah.
So, okay, fine. Lead's sort of kind of a weakness.
There's actually a really good Joker story where the Joker kidnaps Lois Lane and there's like two other people like in the city, and he hides them in these like iron like casing, like almost like coffin type things.
They were lead lined boxes.
Like lead lined boxes and stuff like that. And like, so Joker like tells Superman to go find him. He like x-rays the whole thing. He's like, well, there's these three boxes over here. He just, like, totally, like, fucks up his plan. And then the Joker's like, or he asks the Joker, why did you do this? And he's like, I just was bored and I just wanted to mess with you. I was like, that's fucking awesome. God, I love the Joker.
It was something to do. He did it for something to do.
So, back to this shit show.
That's what these movies feel like. We just did it because we needed something to do. So, he, yeah. And it's so stupid. We don't get any explanation as to why Michael Myers is superhuman until the sixth fucking movie in the series. And even then, it's so... we get to do that next week. Get excited.
I'm getting hyped. Now, the thing was like...
But baby Paul Rudd.
I actually like Paul Rudd to a degree in that movie. It's mainly just because fucking Paul Rudd. They doesn't age. But that was the thing. Was like...
he does look about the same.
So going from like... that whole explanation of Michael Myers being the superhuman that's just immune to... that feels like he's just immune to everything.
And sorry to interrupt you, but you know what the worst part of that whole thing was?
Mm.
This movie said... we had 6 years to wait for an explanation on these two movies.
Oh, yeah.
We had to wait 6 years.
Yeah.
If you were watching in real time, you had to wait 6 years to understand what either of these two movies was about.
Now, when you go back into my explanation, but it's like, so after you're getting this explanation of Michael being the superhuman that's immune to everything, it's like then you go to a character like Jason. Mm-hmm. Jason has an explanation because he's just, he is technically like he's the undead. They kill him off in three.
Four.
In four. And then they kill him. They hang him. He's basically gone.
No, he took a machete to the face.
Oh, that's true, too. Yeah, it was the hanging, the machete, and then... that's when he actually came down on it. So, he is dead, and then they bring him back to life. So, he's technically Jason's zombie at that point. So, that would explain where he could be like, oh, yeah, I could take a couple of bullet shots. However, it always seems like Jason never gives that... the other person the opportunity to do said shooting. Like,
he's pretty hands-on. He's pretty feisty.
Yeah.
So, but that's part of what you get, because up until part six, Jason's a man. He is an ugly man, but he's a man. He's a survivalist. You get a lot of that. You can kind of piece all of that together with the details of parts 2, 3, and 4. You can kind of piece all that together. You can't figure out why he keeps changing size and shape, but that's...
Why he changes clothes all the time. Like, there's one where he's wearing yellow gloves and he's got a tool belt. Because, you know, handyman Jason.
Tool belts are cool. But him dying and then doing the Frankenstein resurrection story with Tommy Jarvis in part 6 works. Because now, okay, he's the undead. So whatever you do to him, he can take it because he's already dead. You can't kill something that's already dead. It just doesn't work. But with Myers, you don't get anything, and you just have this unstoppable force all the way up through part 6 where they finally explain that it's a curse that was placed upon his bloodline. Just go with us on this one. I told you, kids, buckle up. Where a curse was placed upon his bloodline, and the only way to free himself from the curse, if I'm remembering this correctly, obviously next week will be a refresher, is to kill every last member of his bloodline, and as stupid and convoluted as that whole thing is, at least you kind of have something to hang your hat on as to why he was chasing down Lori and Jamie. Okay, fine.
Yeah, like, I was actually on board with that. I was like, oh, we have an explanation. Because throughout all of the years before the Thorn explanation, I was like, that was my question that I would always give to everybody, is like, why was he going after her?
And a lot of people argued that it doesn't matter because they treated him like a shark on land, like a land shark, basically. You just do stuff. Okay.
The thing is that with the earlier films, it never made sense to me for that logic, where it's like, okay, yeah, it's like it, but it kind of felt very lazy to just go, oh, no, he just does things. He'll just go and just kill anybody. And it's like, but
use that in your first film. But yeah. Then after that, we have a setup where he's very specifically on a mission.
Now, once you got into the newer film with the Halloween Kills, and now Halloween Ends, there is those scenes where he's literally just going around and anybody that comes in his path is fucking gone. And it's just, that gave me the sense, I'm like, okay, all those explanations that people were giving me, that made sense to me. Because it felt that there was no way that you could survive from this guy. He actually feels terrifying. He feels, because he's just so goddamn slick and just silent, that it's like that one scene with the girl that's looking out the window and he just kind of comes up behind her and then just stabs her. I was like, fucking awesome. Like, it was just so damn good. And again, that's something where it's like, because I had my kind of, nail biter, but it was just like my little, just, I didn't like the old man Michael bit. I was just like, I went through this whole thing of doing the math like Loomis and just sitting there doing this whole thing of like, okay, well, if everything from 4 to, you know, Halloween is completely gone and they're just jumping from what is basically Halloween 2 up until then. And it's like, there's so much time. It's
40 years.
40 years. And it's like, so that means that I'm dealing with old lady Lori, old man Michael, who was, I think,
he was 21 at the time.
Yeah.
It was the 78 film. So he was in his early 60s.
So I was like, I was just like, man, I don't really feel like I want to see, it's not going to be interesting or whatever. And then when I like sat through it, I was just like, holy shit. Like, I fucking loved it. I was just like, and that is so weird for me to say, where I'm like, I'm in. Like, I'm in for those movies because of, one, the look of the way that Blumhouse is doing, you know, everything. Danny McBride, like, I was kind of taken back that he was a part of the whole, like, writing process and everything. And, like,
I was, he's
like,
a comedy guy, usually.
Yeah, I was like, oh my God. I mean, I was like, this is really, really good. It's like, all I can think about is Tropic Thunder with the,
oh yeah,
big old titties, bam.
Eastbound and Down, anybody?
Yeah.
Kenny Powers.
And what was it, The Righteous Gemstones? Like I mean, Danny McBride is so fucking good. But then it's like, just the fact that,
and that mullet,
yeah, but the fact that he can be a part of Halloween and actually make it feel legit. And I mean, there was a couple of little things here and there that I'm like, as a little, you could probably plug a hole in that and like it'd be fun, but it's like, it was still enjoyable. And that was the thing, was like, when you go back to watching movies like this, where it's like, where you kind of like what you did with Wes Craven's New Nightmare, and you had to go back into the catalog. If somebody, like a newer fan, did that, where they sat there and watched the newer Halloweens and then went back and watched this shit, wow. Like, that would be very, very hard on them. And I feel really, very bad.
It would be painful, for sure. So, the initial mission that was set up where Michael is going after Jamie, for reasons, was also abandoned in this one. He's just kind of aimlessly wandering around, and then he focuses on Tina, for some reason. It starts off where it seems like he's going after Jamie again, because he picks off Rachel, which is the... Come on.
It's the Kincaid. It's Kincaid.
Yeah, and she was one of the best final girls we've had in a series. You can honestly point to Rachel. Fans loved her. She was smart. She tried to outsmart him. She was very... she had this ingenuity about her where she was thinking on the fly, and... Like, she had her wits about her. She was a really good final girl. And to have her picked off in the way that she was in this movie, which, by the way, she was stabbed in the fucking shoulder. She should have survived that. There's no reason for her to have died with one stab wound to the shoulder.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very, very unsatisfying.
And she died with no pants on.
That was satisfying. However, because she's got some good old leg on them.
She did have some nice legs.
Yeah, but that was the thing. It was like, so that whole scene, everyone talked about the scene with Jamie and the, like, the laundry chute at the Myers house. Everyone says, like, that's, like, one of the... And it is. That's actually a really good scene out of this movie. However, the scene with Rachel, you know, taking a shower and then, you know, having to, like... deal with Loomis and his phone calls, and then their dog Max. What a pretty dog. But like,
I do love a Doberman.
Yeah.
Him's handsome.
Handsome boy. But like, so,
and a good boy.
And so Max barking his ass off because Michael's in the house. And it's like, so,
and poor Max is tied in the backyard and he can do nothing about it.
No. And that was the thing, was like, I was like, oh my god, like there was so much tension build up because you're just going, oh my god, like he's in the house. She can't do anything, or she doesn't know about it. And so that was the whole thing of just dealing with that shape. Like, that's the John Carpenter stuff where the shape is just in the house, and they're showing him in the background, just kind of just there, and then he wouldn't do anything
about it. He kind of just stalked her around. He was in her closet at one point, and she was picking out something to wear, and he was right there behind the clothing bar.
And she's the only one in the house.
She was looking in a mirror when he walked out of the closet and out of her bedroom door. The mirror was facing the bedroom door. She should have seen him sneak out of the door because she was looking in a fucking mirror.
Just creeping out, just...
But she was absorbed in what she was doing and didn't see him slip out. She should have, because of the fucking mirror.
It would have been better if, like, maybe she dropped something and then she bent down and he walked out and then she, like, stood up and then, like, looked in there, because that was a big fucking mirror and it wasn't that too far off from the closet.
No, and it was a direct line of sight out the bedroom door.
Yeah, and
so that's.
To see a big bastard come out of your closet like that, it's just like...
And no, but she didn't see him.
No.
Apparently mirrors don't work in slasher universes.
Maybe he's a vampire.
Sure.
Like, the whole thing, you know, like, even, like, that line of thought was just fucking bananas. Like, it's like, that wouldn't even make sense, because it's like... So she wouldn't be, it's like, whatever. It's shit.
So somehow she missed that, and... It ends up getting her killed, sure. And at some point, he had time to remove her body and come back to the house before Tina got there.
He is good with his body removals.
Where did he put her in the meantime? Because he never left that house until after Tina left.
I mean,
he was in the house when Tina and Sammy got there.
In 78, I mean, he did do a whole bunch of, like, redecorating with bodies. He put them in, like, you know, cupboards and things like that.
Sure.
So, I mean, he was good at hiding stuff.
But he took Rachel's body to his house. So did he have time to run her corpse out of the Carruthers house, over to his house, and then somehow come back to Rachel's house all before Tina and Sammy got there? And no car.
I mean, unless it was, like I said, he hid the body somewhere, like in the basement or what have you, like a place where both girls weren't going to. But then it was just the whole thing of then later on that night taking the body in the midst of the dark.
Sure, but with all the errands he was running,
yeah.
Where did he find the time?
I mean, he is...
He's a busy boy.
Depending on it, on how close the Myers house actually is to that...
Like, I don't imagine house, Haddonfield's very big, but he somehow had to move Rachel's body without a vehicle. And nobody noticed. In broad daylight. Nobody noticed.
With a girl with no pants.
And she was not wearing pants. Somehow. Okay.
Was she wearing the sweater when she got stabbed?
Yes.
Okay. Because I remember her having the towel, but I couldn't remember.
She got as far as to put the sweater on, but still no pants.
Okay.
She didn't make it to putting pants on.
So. Best part of the movie. But there was the thing was
I'm
like...
I'm not going to argue with you.
So, and I was very upset when they did kill her off in the way that they did. It was just...
Oh, they did her so dirty.
What
dude.
They needed to do is
not
they...
not do that.
Is they needed to flip... the roles of Tina and Rachel. So Tina needed to be the one to basically go out that way and then turn around and then have Rachel do the thing where she kind of sacrifices herself and then for Jamie again.
Well, we had to sacrifice Rachel, who was a perfectly acceptable final girl. And if the goal was to kill off your... suspected final girl at the end of the movie, why not just have Rachel go? And then you would have this much more satisfying gotcha death at the end of the movie instead of having to deal with Tina throughout the whole thing and her shenanigans and her... She was loopy.
Yeah. She's like... She's a little Daffy Duck.
I mean, there was a charm to her, for sure. Yeah. But I can... She was irritating.
Now, one thing that I am going to... I just kind of want to get this up and out of the way. Out of this entire movie, and out of all the reviews of everything that we've watched on YouTube and little documentary stuff, and just looking online and just kind of seeing how things are, it's like everyone... It comes to saying that just it seems that everyone doesn't really like Tina, right? Well, out of my viewing of this... I actually thought that Tina was probably one of the better characters in this film because she had more energy and she was believable as that type of character. And that was something where as compared to where you have Jamie, who was a fucking mute for reasons, and then you have a creepy ass Loomis who kind of put you off and it kind of gave you that like just that weird old man vibes that you like, dude, you're getting way too close to me and I can smell the, you know, just your stank breath, like, and it's very, very aggressive. That was not really cool. No. And then you have Rachel, who is Rachel. She's awesome,
but no, they just kill no problem her.
Yeah, but then so now you have Tina. And the contrast between everybody. So when you have so many characters that aren't, that are very, let's say, down here, and then you have Tina who is up here in energy, it's going to throw you off. And I think that one scene where she's just doing...
Maybe that's part of it. Her energy was just not vibing well with anybody else's. Billy was okay, though. Little Billy?
Billy was fine. I mean, he was very sweet. Like, he was good. I like him.
Jamie's nurse. I liked her too.
She was good, but it was weird because, like, it's like that poor woman because she just constantly was like, oh my God, Jamie, like, stop. Like, she was trying to comfort her so much and it was like she was doing her job, but it was just the. But, and yeah, so I mean, there were characters in there that were likable, but also forgettable. Like, I mean, it was just like they were just kind of there. Like, the, like, Billy character, it's like, yeah, he's great, but it's just like. You kind of forget about him. And that's where it's like with Tina, it's like,
until he almost gets hit by a car.
Yes, very much so. But that was the thing, is like with Tina, she was, her energy and just the attitude and the tone and everything was so much more compared to everybody else that it was, I feel like that would be the thing that would put a lot of people off. However, once she got into the whole role of like when she tried to like save Jamie and stuff like that, and she got stabbed. I heard like in one of the documentaries they were doing a viewing, and everyone cheered when she died. And I was just like, I don't feel like that would be necessary. Like, and that's where I was like, I feel like it's weird that I'm defending a character like that. Because it's like, most of the time when you get characters like that, you're just like, no, just flay them in like the first 5 minutes and I'll be happy. Please. Thank you. Like, it's just.
Yeah.
But I don't. But she was still sweet enough. She still cared about Jamie. I mean, she's not related in any part.
No, I agree with you. I think she loved and cared about Jamie, but I really think she should have been secondary to Rachel. If you wanted to have Tina in the movie, she could have been. Okay, so let me rewrite this real quick.
Armchair time.
All right, so let me grab my pen and pencil, push my glasses up my nose. So I would have had Rachel survive. I would have killed her through the movie because it would have been a huge gotcha, but I would have done it in the third act and had her in the Tina role where she sacrificed herself to save Jamie and give Jamie a chance to run, right? But I would have eliminated Sammy because what was even the fucking point?
Mm-hmm.
And Spitz because fucking why? So we would have had eliminated that. We could have still had Tina as a part of that, but made that more of a trio with Rachel, Jamie, and Tina. You could have followed a lot of the same plot beats where Jamie was separated from the other two women because she was in the asylum or the children's hospital, whatever the fuck you want to call it. Having to deal with that while the other two were dealing with Myers on the outside. It could have been a whole thing. At some point, you could have either killed Tina or Tina could have survived, but if you really wanted to get people with killing Rachel, I think the best course of action is to have it look like, kind of like what they did with Nancy in Dream Warriors. Have it look like she's going to get out of the woods. You have that hopeful moment. Or Helen, and I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Mm-hmm.
Where you have that hopeful moment of, oh, she's going to make it. And then you yank the rug out from underneath. And she is killed. That, I think, would have been a much better treatment of the Rachel character. And I think it would have been more of an emotional gut punch than pissing off the fans 15 minutes into the movie by going, and she's dead.
Yeah. And I always said that was this, kind of the same thing with Kincaid. When we did our...
Yeah, similar
retro, it was the same exact thing. It's like, it's not to say that it's like, hey, don't off that character. It's just like, don't do it first 5 minutes. So it's like...
It's unnecessary.
Yeah. And it's one of those things where I think Tina would have been fine, like, even going on as, like, the final girl, but it's like, they never actually said or showed us whether or not she was actually dead. She got stabbed, and then they carted her off in, you know, from the woods in a very timely manner, but, like, the ambulance guys, they just fucking showed up real quick right after Loomis grabbed Jamie and Billy.
Mm-hmm.
But like but yeah, they carted, you know, her off, but she didn't have like a blanket over her head or any of that, so it's like that would kind of put in your mind, it's like, oh well, maybe she just survived, maybe she just got stabbed. And it's like, but it was weird that she got stabbed almost in the same spot that Rachel did.
Again, she didn't get stabbed in any place vital. She essentially got stabbed in the shoulder. And if, from what I understand, at least what the movies have taught me, is that the EMTs will pull the blanket up over someone's head if they are no longer amongst the living.
Yeah.
They didn't do that with Tina. They did it in other parts of the movie. They did it with the doctor and the nurse from the children's hospital who got murdered somehow for some reason. I don't remember Michael actually going there. But they're dead.
Because they were doing this whole thing of when Loomis was like, I want to set up the trap for Michael at the Myers house.
Uh-huh.
They get the call saying, oh, there's something, like, he's at the children's hospital and there's been a situation. And that's when all the police leave and they're like, hey, like, Loomis, take the girl to the station. She'll be safe there. will hold up.
Right, and, which he never does.
Yeah. And then, like, but Loomis was, like, kind of like, oh, like, he kind of knew that that would be a thing. And then on top of that, where it's like, so...
But why would he go to the children's hospital if he's looking for his niece? There's a psychic connection between him and his niece. He should have known there was no reason to go to that fucking hospital. There wasn't a single goddamn reason because nobody he was looking for was there. For all intents and purposes, Tina was already dead. Janie, not there. Loomis, not there. Anybody that was theoretically on Myers' radar was nowhere near that fucking hospital.
Yeah.
What was the point of going? Was it to try to lure Jamie out? Was it to try to send a message? Like, and it was so out of the way going from the Tower Farm back to the Children's Hospital. So we went from, yeah, where the party was to the Children's Hospital for reasons. And then back to his family home.
I mean, he did have the Camaro. So he did. He was able to...
It was a Mustang.
Or the Mustang, yes. Yeah, yes.
But...
I could have swore that they kept calling it a Camaro, but...
I'm pretty sure it was a Mustang.
I mean, they were pretty similar, but it's like, I almost said, like, I'm going to have to look that up. But, like, that was the thing, was, like, so he did have the motor vehicles with the four wheels.
Yeah, yes.
So, but that was the thing, and he does know how to drive.
Somehow.
So, but that was the thing, was, like, he, yeah, so he went from the farmhouse to the children's hospital. Slaughtered him there. Now, the only thing is that maybe if he, like I said, if she only had the connection to him, if he doesn't have the connection back the opposite way, then that could be a thing where he's like, oh, I know that they might be taking her to the hospital. He gets there, she's not there, everyone's slaughtered, but then he's like, boom, I'm going to go back home. Because that's where he's been hiding up all, hanging up all the bodies and decorating his attic and things like that, but... It was just the whole thing of once Loomis kind of got the word that, yeah, there's a problem at the hospital. He's like, cool. I already knew it. Let's, like, he's like, Michael, let's go. Like, you're on your way home. Let's go. Like, there's no problems there. So it's
just, it was such an out of, but then if that was the case, there's a huge error there because he didn't even bother with the initial, it goes back to the initial mission of needing to get to Jamie, which he ignored or deliberately sidestepped for almost two-thirds of the movie.
Yep.
More than two-thirds of the movie, because it was like the last 15 or 20 minutes where we actually get them face-to-face at the Myers house. Okay. Fine. Sure. So I also have this huge issue where this is a standard length slasher movie. It's about 90, 95 minutes, I think somewhere in that window. Which is a typical runtime for a movie like this. Why does it feel like it goes on for 3 hours? Gone with the Wind takes less time to watch. It's crazy how long this movie feels. I can't... And every time I'm thinking the ending is coming, it's not. We have something else to do. It feels like the showdown at the Tower Farm is going to be the ending because we get the big car chase and Tina gets stabbed and those cops are killed and that's when the massacring starts to uptick a bit where he killed Spitz and Sammy. He killed Tina. He killed those two cops. I'm sure he got somebody else in there somewhere that I'm forgetting. And then he tries to run down Jamie with the car and then slams into a tree. But it feels like that's the end of the movie, and it's not.
So I correct myself then. He didn't have the vehicle.
No!
I forgot about that, yeah.
Because it was on fire!
I forgot. It was a lot of hotness there.
So, at some point, he walked from the farm to the hospital where Jamie had been.
Yeah, so it makes it even stupider.
Somehow, this just got dumber. So, he managed to do all of that, and the showdown at the farm felt like the end. There was almost 30 minutes left of the film after that. Oh boy, let's go. Then the stuff at the hospital happens. And somehow Loomis gets to the farm and he's got all the emergency medical services with him at the same time. And they find Tina like that.
Yep.
And she's in the middle of the woods somewhere. She is not in a line of sight anywhere at all.
The only explanation that I got from it was that there's like a weird time lapse where Janie said she's in there, or you know, she's in the woods, like Tina's out there, and it's never shown. And then it's just like a weird cut. Like that's just how I, because even then it's like when like Loomis, like I was more surprised that Loomis just popped out of the woods to grab the kids, and he's like, okay, let's go.
For Michael.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, like out of nowhere, that's when the whole cavalry just comes in. It's just like
there's no. This is 1989. There are no cell phones. There's no GPS services. There's none of that. So somehow they managed to get there in the blink of an eye, find her. That's the thing, is the way time moves in this movie is really fucking weird.
Yeah, I mean, you jump ahead 1 year and come out of coma. Like, it's very, very bizarre.
And but it's not even just that. It's the way the movie is edited together. It feels like... A, it feels like Michael's teleporting around. Like, the car is really just for show, because he kind of, I dream of Jeannie, blinks his eyes and just poof, he's in a new location. Okay, sure.
Poof, what do you need? Poof, what do you need? Poof, what do you need?
That's what it feels like, though. He just keeps showing up. And then the whole time I'm watching this, I'm thinking of Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon, which is a much better movie.
I cannot wait to do that one.
And Leslie Vernon's training regimen, where he goes, God, these kids are fast. You gotta keep up your cardio. Because you have to make it like you're running and you're walking. And then I just think of that whole scene where he's trying to explain his training regimen to the little college journalist there. And, it makes the scene better, because it's much funnier. But he's just poofing around to all of these different locations, and the time lapse, and he's getting to some places even before, say, Jamie and Loomis are getting there, and they're in a car.
Yeah.
We have gone past the point where Jason Voorhees would pop out from behind a tree at a camp counselor. Gone is that idea. This is something else entirely, because he's showing up. Granted, Haddonfield's probably not a very big town, but he is going from one edge of town to the other in the blink of an eye, it seems like, with no time passing whatsoever. And going back to this movie just seems exceptionally long. We still have nearly 30 minutes left by the time they're dragging Tina out on a gurney. And we have to go back to the Myers house and have that whole showdown, which... So, Chekhov's gun alert. At the beginning of the movie, during the day, Loomis is walking around the Myers house, which, sidebar, not the Myers house.
Not even close.
It's this big blue, rundown big blue farmhouse, which is not the Myers house.
I do love in Dead Meat when he's doing his review and he's like, yeah, that's not the Myers house. This is the Myers house. And he's like... Didn't you say that he actually drove down?
There's a cut where he shows up in front of the actual Myers house, the White House, because it's in L.A.
Yeah.
And James A. Janisse, the Dead Meat thing, he lives out in L.A. But he's like, this is the Myers house! And like, then
it made me smile.
It was a cut, and then he cuts back into his kill count for this movie. But so Loomis is wandering around the Myers house for some reason. And he goes down into the basement, and he hears a noise, and you can see a couple of rats running around, because the place has been abandoned forever. And he opens up the laundry chute from the basement side, and a dead possum drops out, and it scares the shit out of him, but he shuts the door on it and locks it. He puts the little spike in there to lock the door, and... because that's not going to play a part in the movie later. Fast forward to Act 3, and we're getting to the climax of this thing, fucking finally. And Jamie goes to hide in the laundry chute on the second floor, drops all the way down to the basement, and is stuck there. She can't get out, because Loomis, for some reason, decided locking the laundry chute was a good idea when the house had been abandoned for 20 years at this point? No, abort. 10, 11 years at this point. And so the house has been abandoned for over a decade. Why he felt the need to lock it, I don't know. So just to set up the end of this film, I guess. And Jamie's stuck there, and we have the whole final showdown, and I'm just... flames. Side of my face. Burning!
Now, like, that whole scene, for me, was really good, because it was just, like... there's a lot of intensity, and it was just the, you know, little girl just trying to get away from this big, big bad. And there was that one part where Michael walks into the room, and he's about to go into, open the door. But then he stops, and you can see, because it's a POV shot, and he just kind of, like, looks left at the door, and then he just looks right, and he goes, oh. And that actually made me happy, because most of the time your villain is going to do the, like, you always kind of feel like they're just, your victim is going to do the obvious and they're going to go in this one direction. But for this one moment, the villain goes, oh, no, I'm going to go for the unobvious answer. It's like, yeah, this little girl is very small, and it's like Michael's trying to open it, and you could just see Jamie, like, just holding on to the door on the other side. And I was just like, oh my god, like, that was, well, really fun. But
it did,
like,
a good job of, yeah, building the tension. It's just, there's no reason for that door to have been locked except none. To set up this scene at the end.
Yeah, I mean, and for her, because, like, and she didn't really have any space to even try to kick it open. But it was just one of those,
no,
like,
the way,
yeah,
it was shaped, it was kind of like J-shaped, so there was nothing for, yeah, her to get any leverage.
Now, I also had this thought of, I kind of feel that when Jamie dropped down the chute, and the way and the force that she hit the bottom, she would have just broken that off, because it was so old or whatever.
The
that
hinge,
like,
should have just popped off.
Everything, like the bottom or something, should have just cracked or something, or just deteriorated to the point where she could have, like, tried to, like, force her way out.
She's supposed to be... Danielle Harris was 12 when she did this movie, but she's supposed to be playing a 9-year-old. So you figure she's probably about 70 pounds.
I mean, that's a far drop.
And, like, she fell 3 stories.
Yeah.
Well, slid 3 stories down, because it was the second floor of the house.
Yeah.
So she should have been able to knock the hinge off of it or something.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. It is stupid.
But yeah, I mean, the setup and everything is just the stupid lock. Now, once you actually get, like, she's trying to get away from Michael, he just walks calmly and slowly back down the stairs.
Why would he be in a hurry?
No. It's like, oh, she's down in the little, she's cornered. Well, then she starts to try and climb up again, and Michael starts to stab at
the aluminum,
right? The crazy part about that is, we looked at some of, like, the behind-the-scenes documentary stuff, and he's stabbing at this with a real knife, and that's Daniel in the container. So he's stabbing, and they're trying to get, like, I guess there's one scene where he actually, like, nicked her or something like that, and, like,
you can see a cut on her leg.
I
think he got her. Yeah.
So it got her, and she's, like, she's bleeding on it, and, like, after that they had to, like, but that was, like, the last take that they had of her. But yeah, no, he's stabbing with a real knife, and I'm like, that's real piss poor stunt work. More piss poor stunt work is that scene where at the farmhouse, when he's in the car chasing her down, they set up Danielle to say, okay, here's your path. You're going to run this way. You're going to cut to the right or, you know, left. And then it's like, so here's everything. They show her. She's good. All of a sudden, scene goes up. Car lights go on. They hit all the fog. And she's running. She can't see shit. And the driver, who was Michael, also, because he was a stunt coordinator as well, right?
Stunt guy, yeah.
Yeah. So he's driving as well. And there are so many scenes where you could see how close he is to her, because he cannot see her through all of this fog and everything.
Oh, yeah.
And
they could have very easily. This was a whole John Landis situation, Twilight Zone, where she could have died because they were more worried about getting a shot and a stunt out with a 12-year-old girl than they were about the safety of the aforementioned 12-year-old girl. And and also, just the scene itself is really fucking dumb, because let's just have her run. She's in the woods. we're going to just take the path the car can fit on. She's not going to just sort of shift to one direction or the other and shoot between the trees that are a foot and a half apart.
Oh, yeah. Like, she's driving in the exact spot where the car would be. But the thing that terrifies me with something like that, where it's like, yeah, you were talking about, like, the John Landis thing. What if she fell? Mm-hmm. If that little girl in the just the height of the filming and just her running, how many times has somebody just
tripped
by mistake? Or there's a stick out there that somebody forgot to clear out of the way. And it's like, in this car, can't really see her. It's like, that's terrifying. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's like, and so the scene itself, yeah, it's pretty nuts, because I mean, it's a car chasing down a little kid, but at the same time, I found the filming.
That's a car actually chasing down a little kid.
Yeah, I was like, that's crazy on its own. Mm-hmm. Holy shit. But all of that, it's just, it seems very slapdash, because out of all the, like, documentary stuff that we were watching, this was the one film where they were just literally making shit up on the fly. And you can tell very, very quickly that they were just like, oh, well, we have this one idea, we're going to do this idea, and then we're going to do this idea, and then we're going to do this idea.
That's why the movie feels so much longer than it really is because it's just a bunch of scenes cobbled together. This isn't a story. They're not telling us a story. And then halfway through filming, they go, you know what's a good idea? Let's put the man in black in there and have no explanation as to his presence at all. And we don't get one. Just, there's a handful of scenes where there's a man in a black trench coat with black boots and a black hat, and you never see his face. You see him from behind, and you just sort of see him popping up in different places all over town. There's a handful of scenes with him in it. And then the final scene of the movie, when this thing finally ends, my God, where he shows up with what looks like a Tommy gun, blows away every cop in the precinct, and then explodes the cell to get Michael out with apparently an explosive that's hot enough to set iron on fire. Okay.
Yeah, the iron is literally smoking and it's on fire. Like, it's got flames on it.
Like, iron can... I mean, maybe I've never seen it, but I'm having a really hard time believing that a man just off the street would have an explosive that's strong enough to set iron on fire.
Well, I mean, like, yeah, it's like, I could think, like, you know, like C4 or, like, thermite or something like that would be...
There are explosives that you could blow the lock open with, I'm sure, but to actually blow the door off and have it on fire seems really implausible, and I need a Mythbusters on this now to see if that's a thing. Because that's way outside my pay grade. But the end of the movie is the man in black busting Michael out of prison.
And I actually think, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but it, like, it just hit me. I think they did do a Mythbusters where they did, like, a jailbreak, and they were doing that where they were exploding different things to see, like, how different locks and stuff would... I think there is something out there. I'm going to have to dive in and see if I can find that, just because it's like, now that I'm curious. But
sure they did a version of that, but I don't, very specifically this scene.
Yeah.
But then you get Michael Myers humanized in the end. So he's built up as being this unstoppable, unkillable force throughout this entire movie, and then he gets arrested and you see him sitting on a bunk in a jail cell fiddling with his chains, and it just is very anticlimactic. It very much humanizes and emasculates him. It just seems super weird and out of place. And then you've got the man in black situation, and the last thing you get is Danielle Harris walking through the precinct seeing bodies littered all over the fucking place, and then her little no, and then the credits roll,
which is hilarious because that's exactly what Loomis just did at the end of 4. So they redid the whole thing, but with and Jamie.
That is the nutshell of this movie. Is this is an absolute fucking retread again. Mm-hmm. We get another retread again, I've seen this movie. Not because I've seen this, literally seen this movie. It's because I've seen Halloween 78. I've seen Halloween 2. I've seen Halloween 4. Like, this has gone beyond formulaic. This isn't a formula anymore. This is simply cut and paste. And it's annoying. And I, for all of the faults that some of the subsequent movies have, at least they tried something to do to make a slightly different movie. And I, granted, it's tough with a slasher. You have the motive of the slasher is to just kill, kill, kill. It's all about the body count. It's all about carnage candy. But the fact of we're basically watching the same movie with different people in it over and over and over again is insulting, and worst of all, it's boring. And that's what this movie commits, is the cardinal sin of being fucking boring. If I'm looking at the clock going, boy, this movie seems like it's got to be almost over, right? And we're only 45 minutes into the run of a 90-minute runtime. Woof, you fucked up.
So, you want to know what I did during this film?
Needlepoint?
That probably would have been a good option, just because that'd be something that'd be...
Macrame.
Yeah, that or knitting. I've always wanted to learn how to, like my stepmom, she does all the knitting and...
Just crochet.
Crochet and stuff like that. And she'll make a lot of, little cute little figures. I always wanted a Pennywise one. So, that I thought that would be kind of cool. And then I'd be like, I'm a 36-year-old man. Yeah, I'm doing it. But no, I actually went online, and I get a bunch of, YouTube notifications, and I'm actually big into solving Rubik's Cubes. And I got this little video notification that, look at these 21 different kinds of Rubik's Cubes, and it's just... this whole, that's just what this guy's channel is. And then in this whole thing, it's like dailypuzzles.com. It's like, go shopping for cubes. I went and bought Rubik's Cubes during this film because I got so bored during and they're fucking sweet cubes. There's one that's like a translucent one that's really neat. And then I got one that's actually like a fidget spinner that twists like an actual Rubik's Cube.
Oh, boy.
So I'm excited for that. So they should be in soonly. So, but yeah, I just sat there and I was just like, I can't. I was so mad during a lot of those scenes that I was just like, I just... And then on top of that, where you're just like, oh my God, it's just like, it just won't end. It just keeps going. And that's when I just got to go shopping. So
yeah,
that's what I did.
It was hard to not be on the phone or reading or doing literally anything else with my hands.
And the terrible thing is you still didn't miss anything. That's the problem, is that there's times where it's like, if you get sidetracked with something else, and you go back, you're like, oh my God, what happened? And then you have to rewind it to find out what the fuck just happened. Never have to do that with this film. Ever. It's just, you could maybe skip 15, 20 minutes of it, and you'd be like, okay, I'm good.
Yeah, unfortunately. Which is a bad sign for fucking all of it. So this is the middle of the half-assed Cult of Thorn trilogy. What's your skull rating on this one, Dara? I don't know. I'm kind of afraid to find out. But what's your skull rating?
This is a one. This is a solid one.
Yeah?
I don't like this movie. At all. This is, on the level of, Jaws. It's another movie that I fucking hate that has the word revenge in it.
Maybe there's a motif with you here.
I don't know, but I don't like this movie at all. I still absolutely cringe at just the continuity. And it's I know I keep beating this dead horse, but it's the fucking eyes and the burns.
Well, the good news is we only have one more, and then H20 is supposed to be supposed to bypass that. Yeah. It's supposed to be a direct sequel to Halloween
Trick or Treat,
Part 2.
Motherfucker.
Nope.
Oh, that's Resurrection.
No.
I can't wait for that
one.
But
Halloween H20 is supposed to be a direct sequel to Halloween Part 2.
Yeah.
So...
like, all that. Like, it, but even though it's still, like...
the continuity issue should no longer be a thing for you, because this, that movie has nothing to do with these movies.
No, but even then, it's just, like, it's having the continuity of them shooting out Michael's eyes in number two, burning him alive, and then all of a sudden skip over 10 years to where he heals up, and the eyes are there, and his skin is not very burned.
And no, he, Loomis is more fucked up than he is.
Yeah, and that's the thing is, like, granted, yes, Michael is a supernatural human who's got this
but
weird
that's
immunity.
Not established yet.
No, and that's where it's like having all the bullets just riddled into him, and then the fact that he can just kind of, you know, bounce back and forth. But with this movie, the kills were very, very weak for me. A lot of them
with the pitchfork.
Well, the pitchfork one was probably the best one because of the setup. Because Michael, the boyfriend with the sweet car.
Oh, the gardening
one. Yeah, the gardening one. That one was really cool because it was just like it was right there in front of your face. You got the full impact. They didn't do like
really
a cutaway.
Though.
No, the one in the kill in the barn while the dude was having like while they were having sex. That one was like it was a weird setup because like you were there for the whole scene, like so they.
I thought things were gonna get real weird with Tina and two.
Like, I thought
it,
so.
It leads
yeah.
to where it looks like it could potentially be a three way.
Yeah.
And
well,
nope.
I was actually kind of proud. I was like, oh, they're also practicing safe sex too, but they're showing the whole like I have like okay I'm gonna lay you down we're gonna you know
it was play, so mechanical.
Do whoopee yeah and then we're gonna like okay now I'm gonna I got here's my condom and then I'm gonna put it on and then all of a sudden now we're gonna do the
did you hear like, when he said ouch when he put the condom on
yeah because he
do
snapped
we,
it and I was just like dude come on
do we not know how to put on a rubber dude come on
it's not like a medical glove bud
but, you should I mean unless you got a hair caught in it or something but like you just that's not. What?
But yeah, like, so then, like, you're into the mode of actually watching them. So it's like you're getting the visualization of everything that they're doing. Granted, like, some other, like, sex scenes, it's just kind of like they're just boom and already into it. So it's like it's whatever.
Or it could be like in the first movie with Judith and her boyfriend where he's got a grand total of 20 seconds.
20 seconds, yeah. He ain't no 1 minute man. He's less than 1 minute man.
Before he's walking downstairs, put his fucking clothes back.
Yeah.
Thanks for great time, honey.
Yeah. And so, but that was the thing. Was like, so the pitchfork in that scene was really cool. And then right after that, you get the big scythe, like lawn.
Yeah.
Thing,
no, it's the scythe. But we don't see what happens to Sammy. Like he chases her down. She's screaming. And he takes a swing, and all you see is a splash of blood go across the hay.
Yeah.
And that's it. Most of the kills are off screen. It's even more frustrating, because most of the kills, the one thing that might have saved this movie from the gutter, you don't even really get to see any yeah. of.
I think if the gore was a little bit more up, this would have been a little bit more of a watchable movie. Because, like, I actually just...
It's some entertainment
yeah,
value.
Well, I just got caught up on watching the latest Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie. And I was telling you, it's like, the gore and the kills were the only thing to save that movie. Because it's like, instantly, I just wanted everybody to die. And it's like, this is
yeah, you
not,
told me nobody's terribly likable.
It's not very likable. And it's like, the story doesn't really hold up. And it's just like, but the kills were just... Like I was like I'm in for it. Like this is cool. Like all the kills were great. So I think with this movie, if there was more kills or if the kills were more interesting, we might have something. But granted, it's like the story, the plot. And it's like having Jamie being this mute. The only thing that I thought that would save that plot thread was the fact that it's like if maybe she was turning into to Michael. And because he couldn't talk, she was kind of, like, developing into him, but she wasn't there quite yet.
No, they just did it, so it was because it was a trauma response or
something. Like, and then on top of that, it's like, she actually didn't kill her mom, or her stepmom, or foster mom, or whatever. And
they kept saying stepmother, stepsister, I'm like, foster.
Foster, yeah. And then on top of that, where it's like, so the mom... I really don't feel like she'd be like, you know, I still love this girl. It's like, I mean, unless there's like some like understanding of like what she's going through or whatever it is. But at the same time, I'm like,
attempted murder.
Yeah, it's like mate, it's like the dad and like they kept saying that the dad and the mom were like calling in saying we love you, and it's like that's not. I was like, I don't feel like that would be something that you would be like, like 1 year later. Like, that's pretty quick to sit there and go, yep, forgive and forget. And it's just like, no, you stabbed the shit out of me.
It's like, yeah, with scissors. She cut her mama pretty good.
Yeah, so I was like, but that was the thing, was like, so the kills really weren't there. I did like the kill with Mike, with the boyfriend Michael, just because it was right there in your face. And on top of that, Michael Myers.
Douche.
Yeah, Michael Myers, like, scratching the shit out of his car. I was like, oh my God, like, just dig that knife in deeper there, bud.
Yeah.
But, like, the one thing that I absolutely hated the most in this film was fucking Michael's mask.
Okay. I'm going to give my skull rating and then elaborate
on
that.
So, one for me.
One for you. It's a 1.2 for me. I was a bit more forgiving for the Jamie character. I thought the climax was at least worth something.
And the Jamie character is still great. It's just, it was very confusing when you have that transition from 4 to 5 and you're like, with no explanation. Mm-hmm. But she still did great.
Yeah, she's great. There was nothing, like, the Jamie character is fairly sympathetic, even though they made her more childish than she was in part 4, even though she was a whole year older, but okay, fine. So, yes, I agree with you on all of that. The mask. What the fuck? Now, I don't think I'm going to say anything that hasn't already been said about it over the last 30, almost 35 years. But from what I understand, it was K&B who worked on the makeup effects on this movie, which explains why Loomis's makeup looked better. But he didn't look like an egg on his face.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't have a mask. For some reason, they didn't have the mask, even from part 4. For what reason, I don't know. So they took a mold of Greg Nicotero's face and built a mask off of that, which is why it looks nothing like the rest of them.
The jawline from the Shatner mask from the original, and on top of that, for number 4, because after they filmed number 2, the mask went missing. Mm-hmm. And so then that's why in number 4, in Halloween 4, they had to basically do a whole brand new thing.
How come they can't get it together? That Shatner mask cost $2.
Yeah. And on top of that, K&B does fantastic work. And so the fact, like, once I heard that it's like, oh, that's Greg Nicotero's face, just like they did with the Shatner thing, Shatner's jawline is square. Nicotero's comes more down to a point. And so that's why it looks so funky. And it's like,
yeah, Nicotero's features were more narrow and pointier than the Shatner features on the original mask.
Yeah. And that's where it's like, looking back to like all the Freddy makeup and all of the, just all the incredible work that they do. And then they sit there and they're like, did you guys just spend like 2 minutes on this thing? It's like,
it was too white. The eyebrows were overdone. The hair was too long and weird. There were a lot of issues with this, but that's the thing. That's the part that I don't understand is, it was a $2 William Shatner mask that got doctored up with a can of spray paint and a razor blade. There was nothing to this thing. And it became one of the most iconic movie props on the face of the fucking planet. And they were not able to get it right. They were never able to reproduce it. In fact, the only one who even came close to fucking reproducing it was Rob Zombie.
Yeah. Rob Zombie was the absolute, and he really spent time on that
thing.
And
his was still off, comparatively, but he was the closest.
Yeah, it was definitely the closest. For this mask, what drove me crazy was not only was like the face just didn't look right, the fucking neck. There was so much neck material on that mask.
And he never tucked it into his collar.
No. It was just like, it just stuck out. And it's like, and then I actually went back and looked at the original mask, and it literally, like, it cut so you could see the skin of the actor.
Yeah, it cut, like, midway down the throat.
Yeah, this was, like, fucking just hanging all over the place.
This one wouldn't have even been that bad in terms of all the neck material. Don Shanks would have just fucking tucked it in.
Yeah.
Tuck it into your collar, dude.
And that's the thing, that it just, it didn't look right. It was just god-awful the whole way. And there was one scene with Loomis just talking to Michael in the house at the end before Michael, like, stabs him, throws him over the railing or whatever. But it's like Michael's just standing there, just kind of like listening to him with the knife, just like, what do I do now? Like, can I stab you now? Like, because I kind of feel like I want to stab you. Like, that's,
if you don't stop talking, I really am going to
it's like, oh, my old friend, I haven't seen you in forever. How are you doing?
That was right before Loomis dropped a net on him and started beating him with a fucking 2x4.
Yeah. Oh, and that was the thing, too. It was like the chain that drops on Michael. It's like, how does his head fit through
the hole?
It's like, okay.
When the rest of the mesh was nice and snug.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm done. You gave it a 1. I gave it a 1.2. I'm really sad. Years ago, this was one of my favorites in the series, and it has fallen way out of favor since the first time I saw it when I was, like, 18 or 19, which makes me really sad. I'm really sad about that. But, anyway.
Yeah.
So it's done.
Now we get to The Cult of Thorn.
We get to round out the Cult of Thorn trilogy, and next week we're going to be doing Halloween. Oh, there's a number on this one. I think it's just Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers, with the debut of Paul Rudd.
Yep.
Which should be fun. And we finally get an explanation after waiting 8 years for part 4 dropping. Okay, sure, fine.
But yes, that's the thing is, this series is not a whole lot of fun, so I try to, like, I am trying to find things that I do like about it. I don't want to be that guy that it just turns around and just neck beards all over this stuff. But it's just like, and because I genuinely love the Halloween merchandise. I think you guys have heard me say that before, but it's just, I always want to go and buy Halloween merchandise because it just looks so good, and it's just like, it's just hard for me to do that because it's like, I, for movies like this where I know I don't like it, and it's just not going to be something that I'm going to want to wear on my body because I know that it's attached
poser
to that. Yeah,
poser.
Don't want to do it. So it's like,
poser gonna pose.
Yeah. So I don't want to. I genuinely want to understand these fans that absolutely love Michael Myers and think that he's scary. I need to, like, in a weird way, it's like, I want to feel that. And it's like, I want to be on that level because it's like, I feel like I should like Michael Myers that much. I mean, I'm a huge horror fan. I love Jason and Freddy.
Yeah,
and it's
just
like,
cause you feel like you should.
No.
Doesn't mean anything.
No.
It's easy to, I should like a lot of things, theoretically, but I don't.
I should eat Taco Bell less, but I don't. But that was the thing, is like, Michael is such an iconic figure in the horror industry that it's like, to sit there, and whenever I do say that, it's for, like, when I'm talking to other fans, they're just like, what? Like, really? You don't? And it's a weird feeling to have, where it's,
and we'll probably talk about this more when we kind of wrap this thing up at the end, but I think, because we might have to do a new ranking with all the three new movies in there, but anyway, so I think for you, it's a respect for what John Carpenter did.
I have tons of respect for that.
Respect for what the character created, because there were a lot of yes, there's a lot of copycats. There was a lot built on the back of that original Halloween movie
mm-hmm.
in 78. It was one of the highest grossing independent films ever made. It was made for $300,000, and it grossed millions and millions of dollars. So this is one of the most profitable Halloween 1978 is one of the most profitable movies in the history of cinema. And so there is a respect to be had. But much like some of the other series that we've seen, we just finished Nightmare on Elm Street, the same thing happened. You've got something magical. There's lightning in a bottle there. Love it or hate it, you can't deny that that's what that was. And it was taken, picked up by some producers, and completely bastardized for a buck. And yes, that happens to good ideas all of the time. And then the law of diminishing returns kicks in, and everything that comes out subsequently after a certain point is just more watered down or boring or useless than the property before it. It's just what happens. We see it over and over and over again, and I don't foresee any studios or whatever ever breaking that rule, because franchise fatigue sets in. And I think that's kind of what happened here with the Halloween series, because this was 1989. We didn't get the Curse of Michael Myers until 95, I think. So there was at least 6 years where the property had gone cold. And that was a huge gap. There was between Halloween 3 and Halloween 4 was about the same gap. So it's not like it was an unprecedented thing, but I really do think franchise fatigue had set in at that point. And slasher fatigue for sure had set in at that point, because this is the end of the 80s, and I think even the most diehard horror fan is burnt out with the slasher genre at this point. It's on the way down. There's really no good ideas left. The well has been bled. The well's dry. We've seen every knockoff of every potential avenue, from being in malls to being at summer camps to killing babysitters.
Grocery stores.
Holiday films from Halloween, April Fool's Day, Christmas, whatever. So there was this glut of all of these movies, and this comes right at the very end of all of it, when I think between the MPAA raping the fuck out of every one of the movies that had come out after a certain point and taking away anything that would have been a draw, because the language needed to be toned down, the nudity needed to be toned down, the blood needed to be toned down, no gore, no this, do this instead, blah, 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 blah. The interest was waning in a big, bad way. And I just think between the rush to get this movie out, because it came out within a year of Halloween 4 coming out, between them working, they were basically flying without a net. There was virtually no script to work with. They were writing as they went. And it's not like the Kubrick-style thing where they had a script and they just kept fucking with it the whole time. They didn't have a script. They may have had something to kind of start with, a launching point, but they really didn't have a script.
We got Michael Myers, and we got Loomis, and we got Jamie. It's Halloween night. Go.
There you go.
That's about it.
So there's your skeleton, and work off of that. It suffered from having a quote-unquote eccentric director. And a lot of people were like, oh, ha-ha, it's because he's French. I was like, or... hear me out. It has nothing to do with the fact that he's French, and everything to do with him being an incompetent idiot and completely mishandling something, eh? Hmm?
Yeah, this one was just not very fun at all. And I feel like I want to like the franchise, and that's where when they redo everything with the latest, like Halloween's, Halloween Kills, and Halloween Ends, for me as a fan, it made me happy that it's like I actually genuinely like those films, and I could buy merchandise from those films, because you know it was something that was they did it right. Mm-hmm. Or they did it right to a point. I know those films don't really, like, there's a couple of, you know, hits and miss points on those, on the type of stuff, but I mean, at the same time, it's like they're still very enjoyable for me, to where it's like I could sit down and watch them and have a just a good old time with them.
Yeah.
And that's saying a lot for me not liking Michael Myers. So, all right. Yeah.
So that wraps up Halloween Part 5, The Revenge of Michael Myers.
Thank God.
Next week we move on to Curse, which I think I might have said a couple minutes ago.
Oh, God.
But, you know, oh, God. In case you weren't listening, we're going to do The Curse of Michael Myers next week. But in the meantime, subscribe and you'll get that shit show and your favorite podcatcher on Tuesday. Like, share, comment. 5-star reviews are greatly appreciated. Hint, hint, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Join us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Slasher at Creepin' It Real. You can email us with movie suggestions or just have a conversation with Lunchbox, because he is the keeper of the email.
Yeah, tell me why you like Michael Myers, because I need to know.
Right. Creepinitreal.cm@gmail.com. And if you've been thoroughly entertained by our nonsense, go to creepinitreal.redbubble.com or click the link in the Instagram bio to get our merch and rep us on the street, which we greatly appreciate, because we love that shit.
Mm-hmm. I do all the artwork, so it's doubly lovely for me.
Exactly. So in the meantime, I have been Mr. Smeg.
I've been Lunchbox.
And clearly, you cannot kill the boogeyman.